Facebook. I confess that I probably spend too much time on Facebook. This morning, before I had to scoot down here to church, I opened up my computer and checked my email, and of course went to Facebook, and of course spent a little too much time on it. I'm here today to talk about how Facebook allows me to practice an important aspect of my religion, which is to witness to the world for the values that I hold dear. How we witness in the world is my larger theme today. The world, imagine, there's something larger than Facebook. But first, though, to Facebook. A few years ago, a colleague suggested that I might like to join Facebook. It would be a good way to keep me in touch with friends and let the world know of my activities and thoughts. Now, being a person who has an occasional thought and who likes to share these thoughts with people, I thought it might be a good idea. In fact, I posted on Facebook this morning that I'd be preaching here today. I don't see many of my hundreds of friends here, but nonetheless, they know where I'm at. But some of you would be here anyway. So that doesn't count. But you are my Facebook friends. And some of you may be quoted in a few minutes. I not only look to Facebook, though, as a sort of a megaphone for my ideas. I really like to know what my friends are doing. Every morning I check that upper right-hand corner. I suppose I should be doing this way, because this is your right, to see whose birthday it was. And I love sending birthday wishes. I sent out birthday wishes to 3 people this morning. I was just so happy doing that. And I just love it. And I love getting birthday greetings myself. Once a year, anyway, you know, when it's time. And I love that. Most of my Facebook friends are like me. We're politically, religiously, and socially liberal. We tend to belong to the same political party. A lot of us are interested in Facebook. A lot of us are interested in folk music. I look to them actually as my aggregators. You know, they're always posting URLs to, this is a really neat article about something, and I click on that, and I must say, I learn a lot, and I click like a lot on my friends' comments. Those of you who don't use Facebook, there's a little thing you can click on, it says like, if you like something that somebody says. There's nothing that says dislike or love or hate, but I can click on like. So I do a lot of that. As I say, I learn a lot from this. But since these are people like me, basically what I'm doing is reinforcing my own predispositions because they like the things that I like and I like the things that they like. So this is fun, but not necessarily broadening. I have another smaller group of Facebook friends who are very conservative. Some are friends of friends, or people with whom I share some interest, or maybe someone that was from my hometown, or some of them, I don't have any idea how they became friends. But, you know, somebody asked, and unless there's some obvious thing that, you know, some warning sign that someone's spamming or whatever, you know, I click yes. I mean, you know, I'm a nice guy. I'm like, if someone wants to be my friend, I'm glad to be their friend. Some of these people post frequent comments on Facebook. I do not check like on their comments. I not only disagree with many of their comments, but some of them I find mean-spirited, ill-informed, and sometimes vicious. The Tayvon Martin, George Zimmerman tragedy elicited a lot of these things, particularly harsh comments. But their views on the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, race relations politics, and the character and the performance of the president raise my blood pressure. Now, in all fairness, I have to say that sometimes the performance of the president raises my blood pressure on its own, but that's a whole other issue. To my surprise, though, I find that I'm glad that we're Facebook friends. You know, I won't say I enjoy being Facebook friends with them. That might be too strong a word. But I'm glad we're Facebook friends. You know, I know we wouldn't have much contact, maybe no contact, if we lived in the same city. You know, these are not people I'd want to hang around with. But, well, this is Facebook. I can hang around with them on Facebook. Maybe because I'm a fact kind of guy, I try to give factual responses to posts that I think stray from the facts. Thus, when one friend wrote that Tavon Marking was skulking about the parking lot, I said, no, he wasn't. He was going from a store to the townhouse he was staying in. That is, he was going from point A to point B in a place where he legitimately had a right to be. So, just, you know, a factual thing. Another friend posted a video purporting to show President Obama telling a group of college students about when I was born in Kenya. And I pointed out to my friend who was, you know, really, here's the real truth now, right from Obama's mouth, that, well, you notice that they only show the back of Obama's head when these words were allegedly spoken. So obviously that raises the real possibility of somebody dubbing in when you couldn't see his lips. Just, you know, simple facts. When a friend complained that, oh, those black ministers, they're only complaining about George Zimmerman, a white guy, killing Trayvon Martin, a black guy, but they don't say anything about all the black-on-black killings in their cities. Well, I was able to point out and give examples of, yes, listen, here are numerous examples in Baltimore and other places of black ministers leading rallies and vigils and campaigns, and that, you know, they are very much concerned about black-on-black killing. If I agree with something that one of my friends say, or conservative friends, I say so. Nobody can be wrong all the time. Now, you might ask, why bother? And frankly, sometimes I think that myself. They say, you know, you might wonder, surely you're not going to change any minds. Are you one of those argumentative people who just can't stand to have somebody say something different from what you believe and have to get your oar in there and try to show that you're right? Do you like controversy? Well, no. Actually, I am probably more consensus-oriented than argumentative. And I like people to agree and be happy. So this is not something that I'm particularly eager to do. This is not something, in fact, that I really like to do. Sometimes, you know, it just takes time out of my day hunting up facts that I can try to correct someone's opinion. Why do I do this? There are three reasons that I take the trouble to do these postings. First, I think it's good to talk to people who hold different views than you do, and also good to listen to them. That it's good to have people like this in your life with whom you are friends, even if in the artificial Facebook sense. To have friends be friends with these people even though you disagree with them. I wish these friends a happy birthday with the same joy that I wish my liberal friends happy birthday. I hope that my being in their lives is beneficial to both of us. This is particularly important, I think, in a society where so many of us live compartmentalized lives, that we, you know, where we live with people, we talk with people, we hang out with people who agree with the way we think, and we agree with the way they think. Our country is, you know, we tend to cluster in groups defined by uniformity of outlook, of social economic status, or whatever. We're pro-life, pro-choice, gun owners and anti-gun owners. Most states are gerrymandered so that there's just one-party political discourse. There's really no need for a genuine political discourse because that district is going to vote a certain way regardless. And, you know, this is true in Texas and other places. It's also true right here in Maryland, where in the last two redistrictings have been very political. There is, a few weeks ago, I preached at our Chestertown congregation. A member of that congregation is running for Congress in Maryland's 1st Congressional District. He has a very slim chance because his Democratic Party has given that district essentially to the Republicans. No dialogue. So Robert Reich, who was the, President Clinton's Secretary of Labor, but also served in the Ford and Carter administrations, was recently verbally attacked in an airport by a fellow passenger who came up to him and called him a commie dirtbag. Well, actually, Reich said in his New York Times article, he did not use those exact words. The New York Times would not let him print the exact words he was called. And Reich reflected on you know, where did this guy coming from? And he also reflected on this barrage of electronic attacks, you know, people on Facebook and sending him emails, really scurrilous stuff. And he writes, "We increasingly live in hermetically sealed ideological zones that are almost immune to the compromising or nuance. Internet algorithms and the proliferation of media have let us surround ourselves with opinions that confirm our own biases. We're also segregating geographically into red or blue territories, chances that our neighbors share our views and magnify them. So when we come across someone outside these zones whose views have been summarily dismissed or vilified, our minds are closed." It's a message to them and also a warning to us, because we're subject to those same forces. "In our divisive times, we must take every opportunity to speak across divides, so long as we can speak and listen with respect. It's also important for people who disagree with us, and for us too, to put a face on the other person's arguments." Robert Putnam and David Campbell, in their monumental book based on survey research, a study of American religion called American Grace, How Religion Unites and Defines Us, noted that people often change their attitudes when they discover that they know and like somebody who is the other. You know, we're all somebody's other. The otherness can be religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, disability, or whatever. In this case, we're talking about politics. In my Facebook interactions with my Facebook friends, I have a chance to put my face on the view of the other. This leads to a second reason why I like Facebook. Certainly, there's plenty of disrespect on Facebook. Some of it, I'm sorry to say, is by my real-world friends who share my perspective on life, but not necessarily my view on how to express it. I mean, some of the nastiest things I find are by people who agree with me, I'm sorry to say. But Facebook is a good venue to practice for what might someday be face-to-face, respectful discussions. I probably won't change anybody's mind, but maybe I can move the discussion to a more thoughtful place. It's important to engage. And as much as I'm a kind of face-to-face person, you know, let's go have coffee and talk about it, sometimes the distance and time lapse of Facebook discussions makes the discussion easier. Even bright people are sometimes reluctant to engage. Here's an example of a bright and articulate friend, a member of this congregation, who did engage with another person, and then here are some of the responses of his other bright and articulate friends, some of whom are also members of this congregation. About 2 weeks ago, first friend posted on Facebook, I had a spirited but friendly discussion with my plumber this morning. He hates the rain tax and Obamacare, doesn't even believe in global warming. Yet we found a lot of common ground, and he forced me to defend positions that I take for granted 99% of the time. The experience was good for me, and I hope for him. Then came the comments. First one. It's only good if you're smart and eloquent as you are. I end up sounding as bad as, quote, they do. Another one wrote, I would be terrified to argue with my plumber. And another, an actual in-person discussion would be a little scary for me because many of my opinions are based on agreeing with people I trust rather than my own research. I would be insecure that my arguments would sound no better than theirs, because theirs are also based on trust as well. Yes, sometimes Facebook makes it easier to have this difficult discussions. It certainly gives you time to do some research, as I was able to do, for example, that I mentioned a few moments ago about the African-American clergy. I could go to the web and look up examples and cite specific examples instead of saying, no, you're wrong. So I have the time to do that. I could do a quick search, and I use Snopes.com, the urban legend site, a lot. The third reason, Facebook buys you time to get your thoughts together. And the third reason, and which is actually the driver of this whole sermon, is that we need to act out our faith in the world. I go to this trouble because I believe that we need to act out our faith in the world. My religion certainly is about what I believe, but it's more about how I behave. I believe that my behavior counts. Sometimes I can influence other people, but my behavior always influences me. How I behave influences me. If I want to be the kind of person who stands up to injustice and falsehood, I have to act like a person who stands up to injustice and falsehood. These individual actions, put together one after another, make me the kind of person I want to be. We need to act in a certain way to be the kind of people we want to be. Cognitive scientist Keith Stanovich, who last I looked was at the University of Toronto, reminds us that being a certain type of person is not a singular event that can be discreetly experienced like a consumption good. We can't just decide, oh yeah, I'm going to put on this good behavior just now, and when I don't want it, I won't do it. We need to behave in the way we believe is right, even if it only has symbolic utility, because it can help us behave as the type of person we want to be when it really counts, when it's hard to be that kind of person. My favorite example of this comes from the life of A.J. Mustey, who is a name perhaps that's passing out of memory for many people. He was a great 20th century minister, labor leader, pacifist, anti-nuclear activist. Near the end of his life, he died at age 82 in 1967. He was out there protesting the Vietnam War. He was one of the active leaders in the anti-Vietnam War movement. And one day, probably in the mid to late 60s, he's out there in front of the White House, and it's dark, and there's few people around, and he's out there in a vigil, and he's holding a candle. And a reporter goes up to him and says, Dr. Mustey, do you expect to change America by standing out here in the middle of the night holding a candle? And Mustey thought for a moment and replied, oh, I don't do this to change the country. I do it so the country won't change me. This, in fact, became one of his standard answers to a lot of issues. He hopes to change the world, but he wants to make sure the world doesn't change him. I have to believe that my behavior matters, even if it's only symbolic, even as I realize that I can't do everything, and probably won't even do as much as I could do. As the Quaker philosopher Elton Trueblood reminds us, all witness necessarily involves the use of the first person singular. It is never somebody in general who bears witness. It is always an individual with an individual consciousness. Think again then about A.J. Mustey standing out there. The individual consciousness, you're going to bear witness. So, although Facebook gives us this added time to gather our thoughts and get our words right, how we respond to Facebook postings really isn't any different to how we respond to any other domain of our lives. The question is, how can I promote humane and respectful interactions? How can I promote humane and respectful interactions? Well, if that's the question I'm asking, and since I'm standing up here in this pulpit, that means I should try to provide some answers to that. And here are my answers. Some of this is so simple that I don't need to spend any time on it. As a friend wrote on Facebook, I'll make the request to not have this breakdown into name-calling, finger-pointing, shouting, and general bad manners. That goes for all, obviously. And at this point, I think it's only fair to tell you that from time to time, I come close to losing it on Facebook, just as I do in my normal everyday life. Here's an example. And more importantly, here's how I stop myself from doing what my first thought was. Some friend of one of my conservative friends really dumped on Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who in fact is not a nice guy. But rather than say, Kim Jong-un is a brutal dictator who ruthlessly represses his people, which certainly is a true statement, he proceeded to characterize the North Korean leader by the size of his genitals, his rear end, and other parts of his body. Now, I briefly thought of making some snarky comment, such as, just how did you acquire this knowledge of the North Korean leader's private parts? I suspected that it would have really, really annoyed him. That was the bad Mike thinking. The good Mike didn't write a word to this guy. You know, because I couldn't think of anything to say that would qualify as useful discourse, and I certainly didn't want to use homophobia, which my statement really would have been, as a tool to annoy this guy. But most importantly, I knew it wouldn't bring out the best in this person. Why was I concerned about bringing out the best in this person? Even this particular person, who I suspect maybe had done a lot of work to bury that best in him. And the answer to this is because my snarky answer would have violated the supreme ethical rule. The supreme ethical rule is not my invention. It was framed by Felix Adler, who founded the ethical culture movement. Adler updated what's generally called the Golden Rule. You know, everybody, all the religions of the world, I think, have a version of the Golden Rule. In the earlier ones, it's, you know, don't do to someone what you don't want done to yourself. And then about 2,000 years ago, it got changed into a somewhat better version of do unto others as you would do and have done unto you. Made it from a negative to a positive. The flaw to this, according to Adler, was that it starts with yourself. Adler's reworking, and the one that I use to guide my life, is this. Act so as to elicit the best in others and thereby in yourself. Act so as to elicit the best in others and thereby in yourself. Start by thinking of the other. If you try to bring out the best in that other person, you will behave in such a way that you will bring out the best in yourself. You might not succeed in bringing out the best in others. You might even discover that it's not something that you're able to do. But that, remember, you are always your own audience, ethically speaking. And you will reinforce your ability to be the kind of person you want to be. I have found this a useful guide to my own life, and I recommend it to you. In fact, I've sometimes thought of printing it out and taping it to the dashboard of my car, or maybe where the horn is, so that I remember, or the handlebars of my bicycle, when I'm sometimes tempted to make gestures to drivers who drive in such a way that's dangerous to bicyclists. So let me say this just once again. Act so as to elicit the best in others and thereby in yourself. Of course, there are other maxims, principles, and guides for you to follow, both on Facebook and in face-to-face communication. The first of the seven principles of the Unitarian Universalist Association is belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Now, philosophically, I argue with this about the inherent word, but still, just posit worth and dignity of everybody. How would we act if we took this principle of the worth and dignity of every person as a guide to our own lives? You know, it's something, it's a principle of our Federation of Congregations. How would it behave? You know, we're not one of those religions that wears special clothing that lets people know what we believe, you know, like the Orthodox Jews or some Muslims or Mennonites or Amish. You know, we just wear regular clothes like everyone else. So, you know, there's a wonderful children's story called The Hannah by Margaret DeAngeli about a little Quaker girl in Philadelphia in the 1850s when the fugitive slave law was in effect. This little girl named Hannah was able to help a slave woman with her little baby escape from slavery because the enslaved woman knew that she could go to Hannah for help because she could tell by her clothing that Hannah was a Quaker and she knew that the Quakers were opposed to slavery. This special clothing paid off. We don't have anything like this. A final story. I was once in a crowded New York restaurant with two of my fellow ministers who were engaging in a really loud and unpleasant and kind of profane discussion. I forget what they were arguing about, but they had this big disagreement. And I finally said, you know, hoping to quiet them down, "Wow, I'm glad nobody knows we're connected to that religious institution around the corner." And one of them looked at me and said, "If people could tell we were affiliated with that institution, we would not be behaving like this." Well, would we behave differently if we all wore badges that said something, perhaps, "I am a Unitarian Universalist, and I believe in the worth and dignity of every person"? Should we make up versions of those signs that you see on trucks, you know, say, "Report unsafe and discourteous driving to 1-800-whatever? We could have one that say, maybe we could wear something that says, "If I treat you like you're not a person of worth and dignity, please tell me." Now I know it should be if you were as though you were a person of worth and dignity, but that wouldn't fit on the button. So for you grammarians, we have to make compromises for our faith. I don't think we're going to go with the buttons. You know, I just don't think that's going to work. We'll have to rely on our mental compass that we perfect as part of this congregation and as we perfect every day of our lives. We proclaim our faith in our daily lives. If we are successful, when we tell people what we believe, they will say, "Oh yes, I can see it in your life. Oh yes, I can see it in how you live." If they say that, we'll know we're succeeding. May we all be successful. May we be successful in this venture. And I invite you to join me for a few minutes of silent reflection.